Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags with 30 minutes on South African and global news. We are live and then up as a podcast. Interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, all in a concise and informative update. It's Friday, the 19th of July, coming up on the program, setting a new path for food security. Can we trust Johannesburg's drinking water? How senior female executives can negotiate salaries more effectively, and how new risk thinking needs to be developed as severe weather intensifies. A day after the opening of Parliament, attention is now focusing on policy across numerous departments. So what is the big vision as far as the Department of Agriculture is concerned? The newly installed minister is John Steenhuisen, who's also the leader of the Democratic Alliance and joins me first up on the program. Minister, welcome to you. And firstly, as far as the sector is concerned and as far as your ministry is concerned, what's the big plan and what's the state of the sector?
Well, the state of the sector is actually very good. I mean, it's contributed by far to GDP, one of the largest contributions of all the sectors. It is a growing sector, and it also provides, I believe, a real opportunity to become the engine room of job creation in South Africa. I say that because of the 42% of people who are unemployed in the country, the large majority of them are unskilled. And agriculture is a excellent absorption for unskilled labor. So if we get the sector growing, we'll be able to get more unskilled people into job opportunities in the agriculture and agro-processing environment. The department itself is in a bit of a flux at the moment because it is being split. This is the second time it's been split. It used to be with agriculture, forestry, and fisheries. It is now with land reform and rural development, and so it's going through another split. So there will be a little bit of a period of readjustment, but I'm very positive that a department that focuses only on the agricultural aspects and creating a conducive policy environment for agriculture in the country to grow and flourish is going to be massively useful as a growth leverage in the coming months and years. So there is a bit of a state of flux at the moment, but it's settling down very, very quickly. And I've already made my budget speech, and I've set out very clearly what the budget priorities are for the coming year. But obviously the broader overarching vision for the department is to become the epicenter of job creation in the country, but also to create a conducive environment for producers, whether they be small or large, to be able to maximize their yields, maximize their profits, and have access to more markets.
Always, I guess, with one eye on food security in South Africa, which is not only an issue here, but something which is a global problem.
Yes, absolutely. And one of the things that we're going to have to focus on is a number of, significantly, the pressure on agricultural land in South Africa. And that's why we are going to be pushing for the promulgation and signing in of the Preservation of Agricultural Land Act, which is awaiting the president's signature. This obviously needs to be done in order to preserve agricultural land, because if you lose the land on which you're growing food and the like, you're going to impact on food security. Also making sure food security is not just about what you grow, it's also about making sure that citizens have access to good quality food and that that those food networks are operating. And so that also comes with improving yield, but also the value chains that ensure that citizens have access to those food items.
In your speech, Minister Steenhuisen, you also spoke about modernizing the sector, greater use of technology. I would imagine the rising influence of artificial intelligence. Where is your thinking in that respect?
Well, the thinking in that respect goes back to a far more basic level. A large part of the legislative environment that currently governs the sector is really outdated. For instance, the Farm Products and Medicines Act 36, was passed in 1947. The world has moved on quite significantly there, and that needs modernization so we can take advantage of cutting-edge technologies and medical advancements, both on a plant and animal basis, from around the world. And so we'll be able to bring those modern technologies and remedies into the South African space through a revitalization of that. Where I see technology being harnessed is there's massive opportunities for with drone technology, but also with extension services. The reality is we cannot put an extension officer on every farm. What we can do is look at putting an extension officer in the pocket of every single farmer, whether they be small or large. And you quite rightly identified AI as an opportunity there. So instead of having to wait for an extension officer to visit you, small farmers, large farmers will be able to input onto an app or into their device the questions that they need asked, the assistance that they require, and hopefully to get a generated response to enable them to be able to get a quick response to the questions or the issues that they're needing assistance with. So these are just some of the ways that we can start to harness technology. Also, there's been massive advancements in the technological analysis of soils, being able to probe and see exactly what nutrients and minerals will be required for that particular soil sample to enable farmers to more accurately and easily identify what needs to be done to improve crop yields on their farms.
You've got the agriculture and agro-processing master plan, but one of the criticisms, particularly coming from Agbiz, is that it hasn't properly been communicated right down the value chain, and that as a result of that, there might not be universal buy-in. Do you accept that, first of all, and then how do you start changing it if change needs to be made?
Yes, so I believe it's a good basis to start on, and I made it very clear. There's no point me coming in and trying to reinvent the wheel. A large part of industry buy-in and the value chain buy-in has already taken place on that master plan. There are areas that, of course, need to be tweaked and adjusted, but I don't think embarking upon setting up a new plan that will take another 2 to 3 years is going to help. But what I would rather focus on is accelerating and amplifying those areas of the plan where the department has perhaps not been moving as quickly as it should have or has not met its obligations, and to make sure that not only do we take ownership of the plan as the department, but that we are setting the example by meeting our obligations in terms of that. Obviously, the value chain round tables are meant to bring all the role players in specific value chains together, and I will be chairing the oversight of that. But obviously, this industry, we're very lucky because a large part of the knowledge and expertise exists in the sectoral bodies, the Grain SA, the Red Meat Producers Association, the Wool Producers Association, and sugarcane growers, etc. And that's where the real knowledge and expertise exists. So the department's role is harnessing that, bringing it together in a coordinated way to ensure that it enhances the ability to improve yield and quality of that, and then of course going out to seek new markets for South African products. And that's also what the AAMP focuses on doing. How do we find new markets for the export of South African goods, and how do we then also make sure that smaller growers and smaller farmers are being able to access the value chains leading to those markets so that we can empower them to be able to grow their businesses, make themselves more profitable, but most importantly be able to be in a position to hire more people and create those jobs.
And key to all of that is access to finance, which is, as you said in your speech, a significant constraint on the ability of new entrant and smallholder farmers. How do you start changing the formula as far as that is concerned?
Well, the department's already started with what's called a blended finance model, which looks at marrying government grants with private loans from private institutions. And there's been a number of advancements with banks. The latest one to come on board is Absa Bank, and they're busy acclimatizing their internal environment to the new blended finance scheme. But then also the other one, particularly for smallholder farmers, is the CASP, and the PESI grants. What these are meant to do is to assist those smaller growers with the resources that they need and access to finance for those people who cannot access formal finance from the banking environment. This program has had some problems in the past, and I've said very clearly in the budget that we will move from an annual grant to making sure that these are drawn down quarterly And those quarterly payments will only then be processed on the back of proven results or demonstrated evidence that the grants have gone to A, to the people who need them, and B, that are making the impact on the ground. What you don't want to do is pump money down the system from national to provincial and to find out that A, it's not being spent, or B, it's not being spent where it should be being spent in terms of the outputs that the department requires. So changing that now to a quarterly grant payment rather than just giving an annual lump sum, I think will bring a great deal more transparency and accountability to how those are being rolled out on the ground.
All right, let's leave it there. Minister John Steenhuisen, thank you very much for joining me today.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
I don't need to remind people here in Johannesburg of the extended cuts in water supply in March, and this really was a new low after months of continuous deterioration. Professor in the School of Geography, Archaeology and Environmental Studies at the University of the Witwatersrand is Craig Sheridan and joins me on the program. And Professor, first of all then, looking at risks that the situation poses to drinking water in the city, maybe the starting point is how do frequent interruptions in water supply increase the risk of contamination?
Okay, so what's going on is when you switch off the water mains, like we're seeing at the moment, where large areas are switched off at a given time, what happens is that the pipes slowly drain empty as people use the water, which is why we see guys at the top of the hill are out of water first, and those at the bottom of the hill are the last people to lose their water. At that point, the pipes are empty, and a pipe without water in it is a problem because there's nothing stopping things from going into the pipe. So, for example, if you have a sewage spill adjacent to the pipe, the sewage can get into that pipe. If you have that pipe near something like a service station, which maybe has some petrol that's leaking out of some of the storage tanks, that kind of contamination can also make its way through the subsurface and enter the pipes. The pressure in pipes is what keeps them safe, because when they've got pressure in, they're always forcing water out, so nothing can actually get into them. And it should only be a tiny, tiny amount that's forced out, so not a lot. But basically, when they're empty, they lose their protection.
So you mentioned petrol. Are there other specific chemicals or pathogens that pose a great risk? And perhaps once you've told me that, are effective or current treatment processes effective enough?
Yeah, I mean, that's a double question, I guess. So the first is it depends on where you are. And if you're getting water that's coming, when the water returns, if that water that's coming down your pipe is either brown or has a funny smell or anything that you can discern visually or sort of from it nasally, I guess is the right word, don't drink that water. Whatever you do, don't drink it. If you can see it's not good, don't drink it. So that's the easy one, which is actually the chemicals, the chemical contamination. And it could be anything, you know, especially in our older suburbs, we don't know what's happened in our properties in the past. If you're near things like dry cleaners, there could be other chemicals that are coming out of those. So there's all of these legacy issues. But typically you can sense these things with your nose. The one that's really hard is the contamination from bacteria. And that's coming from the sewage. And like we all know, our sewage systems are not in great condition. I mean, this is no secret to anyone, really. And for me, this is probably the biggest one, because most chemical stuff will make you slightly ill, and you have to have long and ongoing exposure to chemicals to get ill. You know, it's not an immediate thing and you die. But the bacteria can be an immediate thing and die. I think diseases like cholera kill quite quickly. And it's a once-off shot. So all you need is one exposure to cholera. If you're susceptible, you can die if you don't get treatment. And that's why the best option is that water, if you're still uncomfortable with it, boil it. It's really an easy solution. Just boil it for a while, or try not to drink your water if you're feeling uncomfortable. You know, purchase some water from your local supermarket just for a few days.
Given then the declining quality of water treatment in the province, let me just ask you bluntly, how confident can we be in the safety of our tap water right now, whether it's before or after a disruption?
So my answer to you is I'm relatively comfortable. I'm drinking water that's sourced from Rand Water, and that supplies all of us. So if we're getting water that's coming from the Rand Water system, there's quite a lot of good quality control on that end. Where things are a little risky is about the distribution through the City of Joburg network, where we're seeing a lot of these big water leaks and things like that. That's a different story. But the actual water quality from Rand Water right now is quite good. So if we're living in Johannesburg, if you're living in Cape Town, I think you're safe to be drinking your tap water. That doesn't hold if you're going to one of the more rural areas where there aren't the levels of skills to actually manage those water treatment works. That's, again, a different story.
Something else that we might need to bring into this conversation are the safety of mobile water tankers. More often than not these days, there are queues of people waiting at the tankers. Is this water safe to drink, and can consumers verify its quality?
So my answer is I can't see how you can verify the quality of this. And I wouldn't drink water out of a tanker, just because that tanker can go anywhere and fill that water up and come back. We had a water outage in our suburb when we have this maintenance system going. I'm not seeing certificates of refill or anything about those tankers. So that makes me very, very nervous. And that water, if it's clear, I would boil it before using it. There's no way I would drink that without like some personal treatment on that, or a little bit of bleach. It's a teaspoon in 20 liters.
Are you confident in the Department of Water and Sanitation's auditing process when it comes to maintaining standard of water quality?
Yes, I am. And this is a surprise for me to be saying this, because if you asked me this question 5 years ago, my answer would have been absolutely not. My sense is at national level, we're seeing real change at the moment. So our previous Minister for Water Affairs, Senzo Ntunu, and our current Director of General of Water Affairs, Dr. Sean Phillips, I think they're doing quite a good job. And that's, you know, we've just had the re-release of the blue, green, and no-drop reports. I've said this to someone else before. I mean, these were only going to paint their department in a bad light, and they did it anyway. And I think that takes a lot of courage, actually, as a political entity to do something like that. But they're doing that because once you know what's happening, you can start to change it. And we had this void for 8 or 9 years previously where there was nothing coming out of this department. So I think my answer to you is yes, I'm quite confident at that level. That then goes down to a smaller level, which is Rand Water, and I'm quite confident at Rand Water. At city level, I'm not confident at the moment. And that's, you know, these are the different spheres of government. You've got national, provincial, and local, I guess.
So just finally then, if you'll excuse the mixed metaphor, what I'm hearing from you here is that basically the glass is half full at the moment. You do have concerns. But going forward, if the current trajectory of deterioration continues, then we're in trouble.
Yes, absolutely. And even beyond that, I think we're in trouble for other reasons. You know, we're busy building this next dam in Lesotho at the moment, which is to ensure water security for Gauteng beyond 2028. But beyond that, we're going to come and stuck again. And there isn't really anywhere else to store water. So, you know, as a province, we use too much by a long way. And we've just lucky we haven't had a day zero yet. But I really think we need to start valuing the commodity more. But point is that there are multiple layers that are all intersecting at the moment. I'm really quite comfortable with our stewarding at national level, and I'm quite uncomfortable with the way the resource is being stewarded at city level. But beyond that, we still have to just keep an eye on the situation, because climate change and droughts and that, they're going to come and hit us again, regardless of whatever we do.
Professor Craig Sheridan, thank you very much for joining me today.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Severe storms that have struck the Western Cape underscore the escalating severity and impact of such events, according to the South African-based risk consultancy RiscoNet. The organization is now urging businesses across South Africa to grasp the full scope of these dangers and adequately prepare for future extreme weather events. Volker van Verden is Principal of Strategic Risk at RiscoNet Africa and joins me on MoneyWeb at Midday. And first of all then, what are those specific measures that business in South Africa needs to take?
They should look at their sites from an extreme weather exposure point of view. So extreme weather would generally be described as very high levels of wind, either enormous flash floods or accumulating water, and huge hailstorms. So that generally is where those areas are defined. And if you look at a site, it may be a warehouse or it may be a factory, and you'd look at your main construction elements and say, okay, what is the slope of my roof? How does it deal with huge bursts of water, rainfall, or how much weight can the roof carry in terms of hail? And very many of these facilities were built 30, 50 years ago, where the design criteria quite correctly then didn't take account of today's weather extremes. And you will find that the roof can't handle huge amounts of hail or water, for example. And in that context, the water accumulates and then it sort of washes backwards up the roof. The combination of wind and hail and water being blown up the roof, as we've seen in Table Mountain, the waterfall being blown up the mountain instead of down, means that the water is forced underneath the gutters and so forth. Gutters are blown off, they crash, and a whole lot of other damage like that happens. The same will happen with flash floods. You've got to look at your neighbors. You've got to look at the risk of rising water or torrents of water bashing down walls and coming through your environment. Those issues haven't really been tested up to now in terms of severity that's much higher than levels of original design.
Would it be your sense that many businesses in this respect are ill-prepared?
Yes. You know, many of us rent our properties. We don't really think about the investment around it. And then the legal and or commercial gap is wide because the landlord will say, well, sure, I'll repair, but it's not my fault that the roof didn't perform or that there was flash flood or I had a torrent coming from my neighbor. I can't do this. And it's force majeure and so forth. But you're the person who's running the warehouse or the building or the factory that you rented and you're overwhelmed. So yes, you may well have some insurance because of the factors that are at stake, but there are so many things that aren't paid, the disruption to your business, possible injuries, delays in supply chain, many things like that that are difficult to overcome. So I think the modeling and the forecasting and the awareness of severity of weather on business locations is just an unattended risk at this moment.
Often, if you have to make those changes, though, it can be very costly.
It can be, but the other thing that is fair is that we are dealing with the shock of one event, like this week and last week's rain, and obviously we had the floods on the East Coast, and then there is a signal to us. Now that, thank goodness, isn't something that happens every single year. And if we look at this over a 5 or 10 year period and saying, look, guys, it's difficult. Global warming's not going away. In fact, it's going to become more severe. So what will the scenario look like over 5, 10, 15 years? And let's start preparing. So in another analogy, you've got, for instance, a 10-year refurbishment plan that would go into a body corporate that could equally apply to a business park. That 10-year refurbishment plan should now build in anticipated increases in severity of weather. For instance, the roof tile designs can be changed over that period of time. You can start nailing down the tiles on your roof. You can change the guttering systems. You can really make sure that your stormwater planning is escalated over the next 10 years. And then it can be something that where the cost is really small over a period of time relative to the shock impact of an unintended consequence where, you know, roofs are blowing over, walls are flowing over and all the rest of it. So comparatively, it's a small cost for a significant payoff. And that's actually the essence of risk management. Think about it, prepare well in advance, and the relative cost is tiny.
How do you think the insurance industry needs to recalibrate its thinking?
Well, they have already, Jeremy, and we're already seeing signals, and many articles have been written, that severe weather and stock and storm and all this is no longer as surprising as it used to be. And one is that pricing is changing immediately, and capacity is changing. So what's happened already is that if you're in hurricane zones and things like that, the big reinsurers are limiting what's the severe weather component of your policy to roughly 20-30% of your sum insured. So they don't mind paying out the billion rand, whatever it is, to rebuild your factory when the fire burns it down. But they're not going to give you the full billion if a massive storm or flood comes through and wipes out your factory. Then the cover is only limited to 10 or 20% in your standard policy, and you have to buy more cover, which you can get, but you have to pay for it separately to top up your cover from, say, 20, 30% to 100%. So they're separately pricing the effects of severe weather in various areas around the world. So then as the client, you've had to say, well, am I equally exposed to someone 100 kilometers away or on the coast, not on the coast, whichever it may be. And that's where weather modeling and proper risk and situation assessments are very important. So you can inform the insurers that you do or don't have, or you've made plans to deal with weather and severity in an appropriate way over time.
And a lot of your argument is predicated, I imagine, on better collaborative effort between business, government and civil society.
Absolutely. So if we go back to the nucleus of it, which could be a business park or an area in which you happen to be, you know, located as a business, and then you say, well, from there, the next big circle would be the local authority, the next big circle would be the metropolitan, and then you go into government and policy and say, look, when severe weather happens, it's going to blow off 100 roofs. So, you know, what do we all do about it? How do we turn this into a work opportunity? How do we turn this into a sustainability opportunity, training for people, and start going around and really rebuilding the resilience of our infrastructure to start anticipating further weather? And when one does it at scale and on a shared basis, the costs come down significantly. You can create teams that go around and look at things, or you can go to the local authority and get a proper aging of all the buildings and the plans. So when one does this in a coordinated manner over a sustained period of time, it's efficient, it's effective. You get people involved in the community. You can look at the threat of rising water, overflowing rivers. We've just looked at the river, I think it's Darling in the Western Cape, where they've only got one road. It's a massive citrus area. Citrus Dal, I think, was also affected. Then you can't just rebuild a road every time the water comes down and the river floods. I also heard about a difficulty where they couldn't drain the river because of the sand and the mud that came through because of a whole lot of red tape. Now, those kind of things have to be done quicker, better, much more effectively to protect the entire community. You've got 25,000 people there waiting to pick oranges, and now they've lost their jobs. So much more coordination is needed.
Volker van Verden, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
An age-old, continuing and vexing question in the workplace for female professionals is how they can confidently and professionally set a price when it comes to salary and how to negotiate on this when necessary. The issue is currently under discussion by the organization African Women Chartered Accountants, and it's holding a big meeting this weekend. And joining us on the program now is Nomta Makusana, who is non-executive director at the Association. A very warm welcome to you. And maybe before we talk about strategy, let's talk about the current situation and where the deficit or deficiency is when it comes to negotiating properly.
Thank you very much for having me, Jeremy. I mean, as AWCA, the African Women Chartered Accountants, we recognize that the global gender pay gap is wide. I mean, the World Economic Forum has mentioned, you know, done research, and they predict that it would take the next 135 years to close that gender pay gap. And that's purely something we cannot live with. And so that's really what drives the topic, is around what can we do to empower today's leaders and professionals to be able to negotiate a fair pay and fair salary for themselves, but also how does that impact their overall well-being? That's really what is driving this conversation.
How much of it is simply to do with overcoming corporate prejudice, I guess is the right word?
I think it's a big part of it, right? I think conscious and unconscious bias is a huge issue that is prevalent in corporate. And I think that women in particular bear the brunt of that. I think from a societal point of view, the research also shows that women tend to fear standing up for themselves in corporate because they're afraid of how they're going to be perceived. And so that translates not only to the type of work that we end up getting, even if you've got the foot in the door in a corporate environment, it also translates more practically to how much you're getting paid. So you find that your male counterparts, you know, get way more than you do, but you're expected to do the same, if not more, level of work.
Okay, that's the background. So how then can women these days better or effectively negotiate their salaries and packages and ensure that they are not feeling prejudiced against and are fairly compensated?
So I think that question is quite a nuanced one, which is what we're hoping to unpack with this event on Saturday, where we're going to have industry leaders talking about this. But at a high level, I think the first thing is empowering women to know that they can, actually, they are allowed to speak up for themselves and request those conversations and be honest about it, about what it is that they want and would like. But also, you know, doing the research, finding out what are your male counterparts getting paid. And I think in today's society where we have like access to social media and the internet with, you know, websites such as Glassdoor and LinkedIn, it is slightly easier for us to get a little bit more transparency around what our counterparts are getting paid. But we can't underestimate the role of mentorship and of coaching and of having honest conversations with the people who advocate for you, who have walked the path already, who can guide you on how to approach this topic. So that's really what Saturday is about, is to get that advice from the individuals who have walked the path ahead of us, who will give us the tools as well and help better equip us. And maybe I'll be better prepared to answer that question in more detail after the session on Saturday.
I suppose your entire argument is also predicated on sectoral speciality and demand within that sector for a specific skill.
It is, but this goes across, I mean, all sectors, right? And it's a global issue. I think, yes, sure. For example, we're CAs driving this agenda right now in our space, but we've even actually opened up this event to not just CAs because we recognize that this is an issue across the board. So you've got lawyers who are talking about the same thing, teachers, nurses, doctors, all complaining, engineers, all complaining about the same thing. And that's not to be controversial, but I mean, it's a result of the past, right? And of how these were considered male-dominated industries. And so these industries and the world hasn't really adjusted as quickly as it should have to accommodate women in the workplace.
Do you think that there might be a better negotiating climate for women in the current setup in corporate South Africa, given that this particular issue is being given so much ventilation?
Yes, of course, definitely. If I use myself as an example, I mean, I started my career in 2012 and I would have never dared even have this conversation. I do think that there has been some movement and that the environment is better off for us to actually have this conversation. There's no denying that 10, 20 years ago, having this conversation would be considered taboo. And I think that that's very telling of the strides that have been made since then.
And it's not just about personal negotiation. It's also about advocating for better policies within the corporate environment that promote fair pay and financial education, I guess. And I would imagine there's also a fair deficiency in that respect.
For sure. It's not just about, you know, the salary. It's about, you know, what happens when a woman takes maternity leave? How does that impact your pay and your progression and your ability to be paid what you're worth? It also talks to not just your actual salary, but like, how are we planning for the future? You know, how are we structuring our packages to include bonuses and, I mean, share bonuses, share incentives, and also flexible work arrangements to be able to accommodate our other needs and our other commitments that we have outside of our work environment. So this isn't purely a, oh, please pay me 10% more than what I'm currently earning or 30% more. It is a, how do we ensure that women's pay and packages are well-rounded and can support their full well-being, their emotional well-being and their, you know, their psychological well-being, and also the role that they play in society. So it is a bigger conversation than just the cents and rands.
You will concede that this is going to be a long fight for complete equality within the corporate workplace. In your opinion, what is a good short-term outcome, something that will signify a degree of acceptable progress?
That's an incredible question, actually. And particularly in the South African context, I think salary and pay transparency would go a long way. You know, I think this idea that we're not allowed to disclose to our peers how much we're earning really puts us at a disadvantage because you have no idea, you know, what the other person is making. You can only assume based on their lifestyle. But I think a short-term solution would be saying everybody should have a clear view of at least the band that people are getting paid, maybe not the exact amount of money, but the range in which a certain salary or a certain job is paid within. And I think that in a lot of corporate environments, that's still absent. We don't see that often.
Nomsa Makusona, thank you very much indeed, non-executive director at the African Women Chartered Accountants Organization. I do appreciate your time. Thank you so much indeed. And just before I leave you and the start of the weekend, let's reference quickly our online poll. And it's about an interview that we had earlier on in the program, the safety of drinking water in Johannesburg. Are you okay with it? Are you worried? Or as far as you're concerned, is it bottled only? If you have a view on that, please go to our X or LinkedIn pages. That's also our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We're then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening. Have a good weekend and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.